Welcome, everyone, to Bitcoin OpTech newsletter number 294 on Twitter Space. We are talking about a variety of news items today and some interesting software updates. We have a project for BIP324 proxy for Lite clients, and we have Sebastian to talk about that. And we have an overview of the Bitcoin Lisp programming language, and we have AJ and Russell to talk about that. 8 interesting ecosystem software updates involving Bitcoin technology. And then we have our usual releases, release candidates, and notable code change coverage. I'm Mike Schmidt, contributor at OpTech and executive director at Brink, funding open source Bitcoin developers. Merch?
Hi, I'm Merch. I work at Chaincode Labs on Bitcoin stuff.
AJ?
Hi, I'm AJ. I work with DCI on Bitcoin stuff.
Russell?
Hi, I'm Russell O'Connor. I work in Blockstream's research department on Bitcoin and Liquid stuff.
Sebastian?
Hi, I'm Sebastian. I'm a Bitcoin Core contributor funded by Brink.
Well, thank you all for joining this week. We'll just go through the newsletter sequentially here, starting with the item titled BIP324 Proxy for Lite Clients. Sebastian, you posted to Delving Bitcoin announcing a proxy for translating between Bitcoin peer-to-peer version 1 protocol and peer-to-peer version 2 protocol messages. As a reminder for folks, V2 protocol is encrypted while version 1 is plain text. There's an emphasis in the project for this proxy being used in Lite clients. So Sebastian, maybe you can talk a bit about the project and maybe why Lite clients would be a good use case for this proxy.
Yeah. So the goal of this project or the motivation is basically peer-to-peer encryption for everyone. So right now, all of the messages go over the wire unencrypted, at least with the default settings of Bitcoin Core. And there was a lot of progress last year with BIP324. So starting with the release 26, released in last December, there is an optional support for peer-to-peer encryption. And in 2 weeks, I think, or a little less than 2 weeks, in the best case, there will be the first release that has peer-to-peer encryption on by default. So this is a great development. So the nodes will talk to each other in encrypted. But at some point I was asking myself, okay, that's great, but how can we help other clients to also talk encrypted? And one obvious answer is simply to wait because they would implement it at some point. But another thing one could do is provide the tools to accelerate that process. And this is where BIP324 proxy comes in. It is, as the title says, a tool to teach Lite clients to talk version 2 peer-to-peer protocol without them needing to do many changes. So how this works is by a process in between, a proxy that does all the hard work to translate between version 1 and version 2. And the motivation for this is, it's well described in the OpTech newsletter. So usually Lite clients, they only send out their own transactions. And if this goes to the wire unencrypted, this is very revealing that this transaction would belong to them. So with peer-to-peer encryption, it would be less obvious what is going on because you would have to conceal a man-in-the-middle attack or actively listen there to find out what transaction this Lite client is sending. And also, I think it's great overall if everyone would use peer-to-peer version 2 encryption, also maybe to just hide the fact that you're running Bitcoin at all. So this was the short summary of this project.
I'm curious how reception has been so far. I know it's a fairly new idea. Are you getting feedback from the community, feedback from potential wallet integrators? And then maybe we can also get into...
Yeah, mostly on Delving Bitcoin, there was a few answers. First, there were people offering to help with the maybe factoring that out into a library because there is so far no BIP324 library available as far as I'm aware. And there was one answer of a person offering to help with that. His name is Rustation Rob. He's working on a BIP324 library. So that's great. And we can try to cooperate there and maybe factor out some parts to this library.
You talked a little bit about the underlying library and some of the plumbing there. Maybe talk about Python versus Rust and where you're at with the maturity of the project.
Yeah. So Python is, I think, a great language for prototyping, also for network programming stuff that is used there. One reason I used Python is because all the code was already available in the functional test framework of Bitcoin Core. So there was a good effort by Stratosphere and SIPA mainly to provide the cryptography in Python and also all the integration in the network layer of our Python nodes. So I could just use that one by one, and that is actually also the most complex parts. I didn't have to do them myself. I just copied the stuff over, and the rest is just a little not too complex socket magic with this translation. One drawback of this approach here that it's quite slow, especially for the encryption itself in ChaCha 20. So I thought, okay, why not change to Rust? It is a modern language with a growing good ecosystem, so it might make sense to use that. I mean, another alternative would be to stay on Python and use a efficient library. I guess there are ChaCha 20 libraries out there, but I guess it's cleaner to just immediately switch to a more modern language that is efficient in all sense. And so that's where I'm now.
You mentioned the speed, but we also noted in the newsletter, and I think it was a quote from you, the side channel attack concern. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah. That is, of course, all the things are taken from the functional test framework, and there is this warnings in the headers. So I thought I'd mention that this is, for the cryptography parts, this is not safe to use. I mean, I guess it's not worse than no encryption at all, but I thought I'd rather be conservative here and warn that this is not used. That's why it's also by default only usable on Signet right now.
And so as excited as wallets and other libraries may be to add this sort of thing, it is not recommended for use just for playing around right now. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, with the Rust re-implementation, then the ElseWift bindings will be used either directly or with a library in between this BIP324 library. So those problems would be gone, and then it should be good to use, I guess.
Merch or any of our other special guests, any questions or comments for Sebastian? Merch with a thumbs up. Sebastian, what would you call for the audience to do? It sounds like maybe if there's developers interested, they could help out on the Rust side of things. If there's wallets interested in integrating, maybe they should, you know, reach out in some capacity to let you know that they'd be willing to test it or implement it or provide feedback.
Yeah, this would be very great. So I've started a Rust branch, and where I am right now is just doing a proxy version 1 to version 1, like the simple stuff, not BIP324 related at all. And if any developer is interested to help, there is a concrete task I'm now hanging on. There is a presentation linked in the repository. And one of these slides shows the main loop, actually, that translates between the two versions. And I'm just doing that 10 lines of code I'm just trying to port to Rust, and it's turned out to be a bit harder than it should be because I'm using the select call. This is a Unix syscall for multiplexing sockets, and it turns out this is not available in Rust. So if anyone has an idea how to use this, this would be great if someone could suggest to me how to proceed from there.
Sounds like a potentially good first issue for somebody who's got the familiarity with Rust. Sebastian?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. So anyone more familiar with Rust probably knows how to do this. There is also an open question whether to use an asynchronous network programming framework like Tokio, because right now I would try to do it with only the standard library. I don't know if I should go deeper here. So right now I'm only using blocking IO calls. because I think that's good enough. So we have multi-threading. So for each incoming version one client, one new thread is started, but you still have the socket pair, like the local and the remote socket, and those do that in blocking calls. So I'm not sure if I should change that or if that is really a problem. I mean, for efficiency, the main problem has been, like I said, the stream cipher, the ChaCha 20. So probably this is good enough. Yeah, let's see how it goes.
So Rust developers, reach out to the stack. Wallet integrators curious about this, reach out to the stack, or you can reach out to OpTech and we can connect you with Sebastian. Sebastian, thanks for joining us today. You're welcome to hang on, or if you have other things to do, we understand.
Yeah, thanks.
Next news item from newsletter 294 is titled Overview of BTC Lisp. AJ, last week in newsletter 293, we covered your Delving post, which was sort of a primer for what the Chia Lisp programming language is and what it can do and what it does on Chia. You also spoke with Merch and I on the spaces last week, where we went into a bit more detail and also briefly discussed the post that we ended up covering in this week's newsletter on Delving, which was titled BTC Lisp or Bitcoin Lisp as an Alternative to Script. So AJ, maybe recap Bitcoin Lisp for those that didn't get the sneak preview last week. And I'll also note that the Simplicity programming language has some similar goals to Bitcoin Lisp. So I've asked Russell O'Connor, who's spearheading Simplicity, to join us as well today to help not only provide feedback on Bitcoin Lisp idea and summarize some of the conversation going on there, but also to help us maybe contrast the two, and maybe AJ and Russell can riff a little bit here. AJ, you want to kick us off?
Sure. So the basic idea is script is a fairly limited language, and you can't express a whole bunch of ideas in it. So you can't do looping, for instance, to say, which is something you might want to do if you wanted to do the same sort of thing on each output of a transaction, if you're introspecting that. And so when it comes to all the new opcodes that people are looking at, the introspection ones, for instance, if you want to hard code the concept that you're proposing, then that's fine, and that works for things like OpVault and OpCTV and Ccache AnyProv out. But if you want to provide more flexibility to application developers so that they can create their own ideas and implement them, then you want to be able to do something where they're building the logic in themselves. And that requires to be able to say, okay, for each output, I want to make sure, I want to look at the amount and make sure that's at least some value, for instance. And the only way you can express that in Bitcoin script is by saying, okay, maybe there are 10 outputs. If the 10th output exists, then do this. If it doesn't, don't worry, do nothing. And you've got to kind of hard code that limit, and you've got to write the expression however many times you're going to allow the number of outputs to be. And that's kind of limiting. So for a couple of years ago, I started thinking about it in that sort of terms and wondering if there's a way that we can kind of get around that limit while still keeping script really simple. And the way I thought about that was that, well, Lisp is kind of an old thing, almost as old as all the fourth sort of stuff that leads into script. And it does provide a fairly easy way of skipping those limits. So what does that look like? And so Chia Lisp is something that is actually implemented and works seemingly fine, so that was some nice background for it. And then this post kind of brings it, explores some of the other implementation choices you could make that might be different to what Chia did, but also brings it more into line with what might make sense in the Bitcoin context. And so I guess that's the 5,000 foot view. And then there's a bunch of details, and I'll quote from the OpTech newsletter. The post goes into significant detail. We encourage anyone interested in the idea to read it directly, because that saves me trying to repeat it all here. So I think that's the overview.
Well, somebody who I think has read it directly is our other special guest, Russell. Russell, I guess I'll let you take the floor in whatever way makes sense. If you want to talk a little bit about Simplicity and a brief journey there, similar to AJ's journey with Bitcoin Lisp, and or you can comment on AJ's ideas directly, whatever you feel comfortable with.
I suspect a lot of people don't have any idea what Simplicity is up to these days, so an overview of that would probably be helpful.
Yeah, go for it, Russell.
Yeah, so, I mean, in some ways, AJ just expressed the same background that I had for Simplicity. I mean, maybe not so much the worries directly about looping over all inputs, but a more general feeling of Bitcoin script is very limited in its computational abilities, especially since most of the operations were disabled early in Bitcoin's life by Satoshi. And what got me excited about Bitcoin way back in the day was the idea of programmable money. So I spent a lot of time thinking about how one would create a programming language in the context of the blockchain, which is quite a bit different from the context that normal programming languages operate in, and that has led me to design Simplicity, which is sort of the low-level consensus language that would be suitable for a blockchain environment. For like instance, most programming languages are designed to be repeatedly run under multiple input conditions, and so you can explore, you know, various outputs on various inputs, right? But in the blockchain language, you have sort of this potential of a bunch of different ways that your program could be, your transaction could be executed or spent in some case. But in the end, it only gets spent in one particular way. And it's in some sense, it only gets executed once, right? And so this has led me to a design of a language that differs from maybe common programming languages, because I think the blockchain has unique circumstances and requires sort of a unique answer.
Well, maybe that's a good segue then. You mentioned Simplicity was sort of thought of in the context of a blockchain. Maybe, so where did you end up with that approach from a ground up approach like Simplicity versus something like repurposing, if you will, an existing programming language like Lisp? Like how should we think about the differences that occurred from those different approaches?
Yeah, so one of the major aspects of Simplicity design that was influenced by this is sort of the pruning aspect of the language, right? So if you have an if statement in a programming language, you have two branches, right? But if you're only executing the program once, typically you will only execute one of the two branches of that if statement. And then that other branch, I mean, this is true even in Bitcoin script where you have an op if statement, right? During redemption, only one of the two branches of the op if gets executed, right? And the rest of the branch has to be exposed and is just sort of lying there, taking up block space, right? So one of my early design decisions was to prune away unexecuted branches, and it uses this Merkleized abstract syntax tree, the original MAST, as I like to call it, so that the syntax tree of the language, the program itself is stored as a syntax tree, and then that syntax tree can get pruned away of all those branches that never get taken, reducing blockchain space potentially, usually, and increasing privacy because you don't even expose those conditions. And of course, eventually that MAST idea got incorporated into the Taproot proposal. And so we have a certain aspect of that available in Bitcoin today, which is great.
AJ, any thoughts so far on what Russell's said?
The only one is a slight digression. Do you have any idea in practice how much difference the true MAST makes compared to Taproot's?
I guess I don't. Like, one thing is that in Taproot, you sort of have to bring all your branches to the top level, right? And this can involve sort of an exponential blow up in the branching you will take. Like, if you have a bunch of sequential decisions, you can sort of put them in sequence and take one branch out. But if it makes all those choices,
yeah. So if, up you, at the top, if you got a bunch of
you only have
ends of ores.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
The Taproot way is pretty crap, but
I mean, it's not so bad. It's just bad on the computation side because in the end, only one branch gets exposed, and that's sort of logarithmic in the size of the number of branches. The operational aspects of the verification on the blockchain aren't so bad. It's just that you have to compute that giant tap tree.
AJ, maybe in an effort to suss out for us listeners sort of the differences here a little bit further, maybe, and not to cause drama per se, but like Russell's been working on this for several years, but you've chosen to go a different route. Maybe if you explain your choice in going this Lisp route, it will help us understand a bit more about the diverging approaches.
I like simplicity, and my fondest hope for the outcome here is that we have both of them working and explore what scripts look in both of them, and that improves both of them, and we pick something, we end up with something really good. So I think the Lisp approach is different and interesting enough to be working on, rather than I think simplicity is bad. It is where I'm coming from. So asking why simplicity is bad kind of misses the point, but I'll answer it anyway. So the thing I had a look at the simplicity PR, and the thing that kind of scared me about it was its size and the number of consensus specification points. So like one of the fundamental things with simplicity is that you want a bunch of jets to make common operations fast. And so you've got jets for like SHA and for SECP256 and for addition and multiplication, and all that makes perfect sense. But the way that they end up getting done in simplicity is you've actually got six jets for all those for the SHA things and a similar number for the SECP, and depending on how you look at addition is actually 32 jets or something, one for each different size of number, and that makes perfect sense coming from the design of simplicity and kind of the constraints that come from that. But my gut reaction to that was I don't like it, so I want to see what else is possible.
That's fair. And when you're saying you'd like to see both of these in action, I assume you're referring to getting working code up on Inquisition and folks being able to build there. Is that
well, I imagine that the working code for simplicity will be up on the Elements testnet or Liquid proper before too long. I don't know. But I'm more mean seeing what it looks like when you write a vault or a payment pool or a like L2 implementation or a Ccash anyprev out. You could get the same functionality with simplicity or with Lisp as Ccash anyprev out without actually having the consensus change for Ccash anyprev out. Like you just implement it yourself and go with it without having to wait for consensus on some particular spec to build. And so seeing how that turns out in practice is kind of what I'm interested in.
Russell, is there a timeline for simplicity on Elements or Liquid? Or
that's mean.
Well, if there's not, there's not. I'm just curious.
No, it's for last year, it's been the goal to get at it in the next 6 months. And I think we're getting a lot closer now. I just want to read it before I go on. I just want to say that I totally agree with AJ about multiple implementations. And I think actually even having BTC Lisp as a contrast to simplicity, not only can they help each other's with design, but if we just had simplicity, people would have the question, well, is this really the best thing to do? And then having like two or more things to contrast, we'll be able to like really put them head to head and see if, like, I've made some design choices and I'm not entirely sure whether they're the best choices. And so it'll be good to see good to see a comparison of that. But yeah, when I first did Simplicity, right, I was like, okay, we do the core language, we get the interpreter working for that. And then the last step is to create a bunch of jets, right? It's sort of like a single line item in my to-do list of like, just build a bunch of jets for the various operations that I think people want to do. But that process has turned out to be much more, not necessarily difficult, but longer than I expected. We've had to create a bunch of jets, and AJ is absolutely right with his understanding, right? We have multiple different widths of integer operations for jets, and I even wanted big integer jets because people might want to do cryptographic operations on maybe different curves and stuff like that that haven't made the cut into it, right? So I both think that there are too many jets and too few jets at the same time. And writing all the jets is much more finicky than I expected, right? For every jet, there seem to be a bunch of corner cases or decisions that need to be made, like how are you going to divide by zero? What are you going to do in that case, right? What are you going to do when you take a modulus by zero? And then everyone has to agree with it, so it has to be clearly written out what you're going to do. In the end, I have basically three implementations of every jet. One reference implementation I've written in Haskell, another formal specification, you might call it, written in Simplicity itself, and then it's C implementation on a test suite to like run all three against each other on various randomized inputs. Then you have to determine a good set of distributions of those randomized inputs to exercise them all, and you do this for every jet. And it's tedious, so it's error prone, so you really have to like try to be careful to get it correct, right? And there have been many other blockchains that have run into problems, right? Apparently TLS had a division by negative numbers issue. I know Ethereum had like some unclear specification of one of their language primitives that they added, right? So it really takes a lot of time and effort to like carefully nail down everything so that you can avoid this sort of ambiguity, which I've been trying to do. And that's just been taking a lot of time. But I feel I'm getting very close now. I don't want to commit to anything, but I think we're getting very close now.
Have you had any luck with the I don't know what you call it, the provable spec to C code sort of stuff?
Yep.
Like to link the different implementations and prove that they're the same?
Yeah, I have been working very slowly on that. I think it's doable, but it's very expensive. So most recently I've been working on proving the correctness of the SECP256K1 modular inverse code, and using the verifiable software toolchain to prove it's correct and then eventually prove the jet is correct. This is not, by far, not the easiest jet to work with, right? Right, I could prove addition jets, you know, correct much more easily. But I thought the modular inverse code was like difficult enough to show that if we can prove the correctness of the modular inverse jet, then we can basically prove any jet correct.
Merch.
Okay, completely different topic. You both have mentioned that one of the things that the Bitcoin script language cannot do is loops. So I'm wondering if you are introducing the capacity to essentially have a Turing complete language instead, have you considered how we are going to restrict transaction scripts so that we are sure that we can evaluate them in a limited time?
So if I go first, I've got the easy answer and Russ has got the awesome answer. So for the Chia approach, it's just that you'll have the transaction or the input specify a limit on how much computation that evaluating the thing's going to take. So I'll have a 200 byte script or something, and I'll say this is going to take 40,000 units of computation, and that 40,000 units of computation will perhaps increase the weight of the transaction and therefore make it more expensive. And if it turns out the computation goes over 40,000 units, then the transaction is just invalid. And that's pretty much, that's slightly different to what Chia does, but in essence, the same thing, and seems like it should be fairly easy to make work. I haven't done all the details yet because I haven't hooked it up into actual transaction processing, but I don't see any problems. Simplicity has a much cooler answer.
Yeah, so Simplicity doesn't have unbounded loops in it, right? So you can't, and you might think you can't just loop over all inputs, right? But since there are only, I mean, AGA has this in his comment, and he's exactly right. There's only well under 2 to the 32, like you just can't exceed 2 to the 32 inputs, right? So you can just write a subroutine that tries up to 2 to the 32 inputs with a fast path to exit early by calling a routine that goes over 2 to the 31 inputs twice for the first half and second half, and the 2 to the 31 routine calls a subroutine that runs over 2 to the 30 inputs, and you get this 30 level nested thing. But hopefully we can design things so that can get pruned away, so when you only have 10 inputs, you don't have to even expose all that nesting. But yeah, this was one of my original thinking thoughts, was that Bitcoin script has this unique property that, you know, you can't run in, you cannot have arbitrarily, you can't have unbounded computation. It's just not expressible. And I was pretty big on preserving that when I was first designing Simplicity. So in Simplicity, can only do a bounded amount of computation. And because of the static typing and various things of Simplicity, you can just do this this pre-processing step where you do an analysis of the presented script program, and you can come up with an upper bound on the amount of computational operations, you know, the number of jets, how many times they could be executed. And you can come up with a total bound of like a maximum amount of computation that this program will need to take before you execute it. This is analysis that you could in principle do with Bitcoin script. You could just look over the script and look through the op-if statements and determine how many sig hash operations you're going to do and get an upper bound on like what's the worst case execution going to be. And I used to think that was very important to do. Over the number of years, I've softened a little bit on it. I still think it's kind of important, but maybe not as super important as I used to think about it. If you want to waste people's time, you can always make an invalid script that goes up to the limits and then fails at the last moment, and you can still waste a bunch of time that way. But I still think it's nice, and I do like it very much. And then we use the weight mechanism, basically introduced by TapScript. In TapScript, you have to use like I think it's 50 weight units per sig hash signature checking operation. As you run signature, your initial budget is basically the size of your witness element. And as you go through sig signature checking operations, you start using up 50 of your weight units per operation. So Simplicity builds on that, except we have more operations that are expensive than just signature checking. But it follows the same idea that we try to normalize the cost to a sig check operation costs 50 units. We compute this, use static analysis to compute a bound on the total amount of computation will be needed. And then we make sure that we have enough weight to cover that worst case scenario. And if not, then the transaction fails even before you execute it. And if you need to do something expensive, and you don't have the witness stack for it, the current plan is just to pad it by using the Taproot Annex and fill it with a bunch of zeros to increase your transaction weight so that you have the budget to do whatever expensive computation that you might need to do. I don't think this will be necessary for most cases, but it's sort of a safety thing in case you do need to do it. You can always pad the Annex. That, of course, increases your transaction weight, but that's exactly the purpose of this, to make the transaction weight reflect your operational costs.
It feels like if we're just going to pad transactions with useless data that we should be able to maybe rather have a field in the annex where we say, treat this as if it had more weight than it looks like, and say, like, I'm willing to pay whatever weight you put there, and it has to be higher than the actual transaction length. So would indicate, but yeah, just writing a bunch of zeros into the blockchain seems a little wasteful.
Yeah, no, I think that would be the right way to go. The nice thing about the zeros is it's totally backwards compatible and everyone can understand it. And the annex transaction format is still up in the air. So whatever choice we make would ideally be compatible with however we decide to like treat annex data.
Right, but since it would only claim more weight than it has, it would also be fine if we just said you can have a number there that indicates that you're claiming more weight than your transaction length would indicate, because then the new nodes that enforce the rules, the nodes and miners that enforce the new rules would limit the block to a lower size due to you claiming too much. So it should be fine with backwards and forwards compatibility, right?
I think that's roughly equivalent to just you could imagine if you do a new serialization format for the transaction that you use saving to disk and doing over the network, where you just compress all those zeros into the number of zeros. So I think they're kind of equivalent in that sense.
Yep, I agree.
As we look to wrap up this news item, AJ, maybe you want to comment on your Lisp Play repository and the Python file that you have there, if that's something that you want people to start playing with or not, or what you plan to do there.
It's a totally fun thing to play with. There's a whole bunch of examples that I wrote down when I was testing things that eventually get into almost doing interesting stuff with actual transaction data, like some of which I pulled off the actual blockchain. I'm hoping my next post will actually not be background information, but be an actual interesting use case of all this. But I haven't written it yet, and I'm still figuring out how to do it exactly. So to be continued, I guess. It's fine to play around with the Python thing. There are definite bugs in it. The design of the language will almost certainly change, but I mean, it's a Python thing. It's fun to play with. Go for it.
Russell, any parting words from yourself?
Yeah, you can find our Simplicity repository. If you just search for like GitHub Simplicity, you should find it. It's under github.com/blockchain/research/simplicity. And I do want to emphasize that Simplicity is low level, right? It's not something that's meant to be written by hand. And we're working on a new project called Symfony, which is sort of the front end for Simplicity. And that's something that compiles to Simplicity. And hopefully the front end language will be more approachable. It'll be easier for people to get into using Simplicity and building covenants and interesting use cases with that. And we should have a nice web ID coming up soon. So stay tuned for that.
Russell, AJ, thank you both for taking the time to join us today. You're welcome to stay on or free to drop if you have other things to do.
Thanks.
Next section from the newsletter is our monthly segment on changes to services and client software. We have 8 of those this week. This is highlighting services and client software or wallets that are implementing interesting Bitcoin technology. Obviously, there's a lot of releases. There's a lot of open source software. There's a lot of interesting projects. We try to highlight ones that are adopting or pushing the envelope on specifically Bitcoin tech that we talk about in the OpTech newsletter. The first one here, BitGo adds RBF support, and there's a blog post that they put out about this on the technical portion of the BitGo blog, announcing support for fee bumping using RBF, available in their wallet and also their API. Merch, as BitGo is your alma mater, do you have any inside baseball on this item?
Yeah, I picked some of the people that are still DARE's brains, and apparently they rolled it out with being on by default, which surprised me a bit. And so far, no complaints. So, yeah, I'm kind of excited that that is finally here, because I had already looked into implementing RBF years ago. I mean, RBF itself was defined in, what, 2015, 2016? So, yeah, I think it's interesting that it's now available at BitGo, and that would make it available to a bunch of Bitcoin businesses that use BitGo as custodian or wallet service provider. So maybe we'll see a little bit of a peek on the RBF transactions on the network.
Phoenix Wallet version 2.2.0 being released. I thought there were two interesting big items here. The first one is that Phoenix can now support splices while at the same time making a Lightning payment. And there's some technology under the hood that we've talked about previously which facilitates this. It's achieved using the Quiescence protocol, which is something that we covered, I think, in a few different newsletters, but I noted newsletter 262 specifically here because that is the Eclair PR that implemented this feature, and Phoenix uses Eclair. The second item that I thought was interesting about this Phoenix release was they're improving their swap-in feature, both from a privacy perspective and a cost perspective. And the technique that they use to achieve that is this swap route protocol, which we link to in the write-up. And they note in that swap route protocol write-up on their blog that they think that they can make this cheaper by 16% if the swap transaction has one input, and 23% for two inputs, and 27% cheaper for three inputs. And as a reminder, Phoenix is a single channel Lightning wallet, so the swapping in is involving that single channel. Merch, sorry, I didn't see you had your hand up.
No, I just put it up. yeah, I thought this is pretty exciting. So swapping Potentium is just generally super cool. And as a reminder, it works by essentially, when you receive funds that are to be added to your Phoenix channel, in this case, you receive them to a 2-of-2 locked output that, after a timeout, becomes spendable by just yourself. So you sort of stage funds that are then locked to both you, Phoenix, and Phoenix. And that allows them to have a zero-conf splice in. And because while it's locked, of course, they know that it cannot be double spent, and they can therefore splice it in and immediately pick up payments on the channel again. And before, they were using what I think was a pay-to-witness script hash construction of the same. They already had the swap-in Potentium construction, but with a pay-to-witness script hash output. And then, of course, you have to have the entire logic of this timeout and everything right there present in the output script. But with a pay-to-taproot construction, you can make the happy path where Phoenix and the user agreed to splice it in. You can make that a key path spend. So instead of having a complicated output script that you have to reveal and satisfy, and where you have to show the branches that weren't used in the input later to satisfy the spending, here you never show that. It just looks like a single sig pay to taproot input as long as the timeout isn't hit. When it times out, of course, the user will sweep it, and then they have to reveal the script path. So yeah, I think it's just cool to see more businesses and implementations build stuff based on music too. And yeah, it's been a very long time since that's been coming, and now it's just arriving in the end user apps.
Merch, you mentioned swap in Potentium, and we discussed that in newsletter 233, if folks are curious, under the news titled Non-Interactive Lightning Channel Open Commitments. And I believe for that podcast, 233, we also had Z-Man and Jesse Posner on to talk about that particular idea. So if folks are curious of some of the underlying technology that we talked about with this Phoenix release, check that out as well. Next piece of software that we highlighted is the BitKey hardware signing device being released. The BitKey device is a hardware device that's designed to be used in this 2 of 3 multi-sig setup that the BitKey folks have architected. So it involves a mobile application for your mobile device, and there's a key there as well. And then you have a physical piece of hardware called this BitKey, which is an interesting form factor, as I think it's there's no screen and there's just maybe a fingerprint reader. And then there's a third key, which is BitKey's server key, and there's source code for the firmware and various components, including the recovery, which BitKey is focused on being able to recover if you lose your keys or phone. I have not tried the device myself, but they've released that recently, and there's a bunch of write-ups on their blog that are technical as well if you're curious about the inside baseball to BitKey. Merch, any thoughts on BitKey?
I think it's interesting in the sense that it's very similar to how BitGo has always been setting up their wallets. So you essentially have one or two keys with the customer at BitGo, and then one with a key recovery service or as a backup, and finally the BitGo key. In this case here, it's of course Square, your hardware device, and your mobile phone. And what this allows you to do is, of course, to have a policy how you can spend a small amount just with your mobile device. And then if you want to spend a bigger device, they basically require you to also sign off with your hardware wallet. You set that up yourself, I think, the limit. But that way, that means you get access to small amounts of money on the go, but you get the security of having a second factor that you don't need to carry around with you for the bigger payments. And so generally, it strikes me as a UX choice that is very comfortable and convenient. The big drawback, of course, is that Block gets a full view of all your activity in the wallet, whereas most hardware wallets are just a single key. And I don't know exactly how much insight they have, but for the most part, I understand it just runs on your end and they do not actually see your payments at all unless you, for example, would use their Electrum server to get updates. But for the most part, you can set it up in a way that it's more private. And here, you're definitely fully transparent to Block. That's at least how I understand it. So, yeah, I'm curious what people will write about it that try it out, whether they can confirm that it actually has a very nice UX, which seems to have been a focus for Block. And maybe a good choice for sort of the not necessarily diehard privacy maximalists, but people that are more concerned about losing access themselves.
Next piece of software is Envoy version 1.6.0 being released. This is a wallet software, and they've added replace by fee RBF support to achieve two particular end user features. The first end user feature is fee bumping transactions, as we normally discuss here on OpTech. And the second one is one that we've been talking about more recently. It's becoming more common, but this idea of canceling a transaction using replace by fee. We've seen it a few times in our client and service updates section recently. It's becoming more common. Merch, any thoughts?
Yeah, I don't know. I've held the position before. I'm not super strong on it, but as long as the transaction unconfirmed, it is essentially just a notification to the other party that you intend to pay them, a payment promise, as you will. But of course, that's not fully true because the other party can also interact with the transaction and, for example, CPFP it or PIN it. But I find it very natural that while a transaction remains unconfirmed, especially if you might have sent it at a very low fee rate, that you get the ability to cancel it. So I think it's interesting to see that arrive in wallets when last year we had these big discussions about zero-conf safety, and now it seems to be swinging a little bit in the other direction.
VLS version 0.11.0 being released. This is still labeled as beta software on the GitHub, but maybe I should recap VLS first so we can get into this release. But VLS is a project for separating signing keys in a Lightning node from the actual Lightning node's operation. And this release is adding to VLS a feature that they've called tag team signing, which allows multiple signing devices to authorize transactions for the same Lightning node. And I think it's an important distinction here. Once you have multiple signing devices, people think multi-signature or multiple devices that need to sign in order for a transaction to go through, where in this case, it's basically the same key, but just on different devices. So they go into the blog post, different use cases for users and businesses that can be enabled with having this kind of feature. Rich, did you get a chance to look at that?
Not a lot. Just I looked a little bit at this tag team signing, and I think it's an interesting idea to have multiple signers. I know that we used that in the context of business wallets at BitGo back then too. Like, just when you have really, really big amounts you probably want to have multiple sets of eyes on it, and to build that into a Lightning wallet signing device makes also sense to me.
Next project that we highlighted was another signing device being announced. Recently announced Portal device works with smartphones using NFC, which I think is like sort of that sort of tap to pay kind of thing that you may use on your phone. And there's hardware and software source code available. So this is Alikos went off and built this. He was a Brink grantee for a while working on BDK. I believe Portal is built on BDK, and I saw it got a lot of traction online. Looks like an interesting hardware signing device. Haven't tried that one either myself, but wanted to highlight that. Rich, did you look at Portal at all? Or I think it's 2022 you may have seen online as well.
I did see the announcement, but I haven't looked much into it yet, no.
Brains mining pool adding Lightning support is the next item that we highlighted this month. So Brains has a mining pool, and they announced a beta program for getting mining payouts through Lightning. Now, the announcement that we linked to in the write-up is actually a Twitter post. I was hoping to get a little bit more information about how they plan to do that exactly, given that things can be reorged, and there's potentially thresholds. I wanted to get some of the details there. That sounds interesting. I know it's something also that the Ocean mining pool was planning on working on as well. Or maybe they have something that I haven't seen yet either. It's cool to see this being worked on at the mining pool level. Merch, thoughts?
I only looked briefly at their tweet, and they say that they won't have a minimum and they will not take any fees on the Lightning withdrawals. So on the one hand, I think that it's a natural good fit. There's this one big wallet that will do a lot of sending. The amounts are rather on the smallish side. I assume that they would have at least some level of depth that they wait for. Maybe 20 blocks, maybe all 100 blocks before the payouts are mature and they would credit their customers. But I haven't verified that. That's just gut feeling. But on the other hand, if you have a wallet that only sends out, you probably get a little bit of a liquidity management headache. So yeah, I'm curious to read more. Maybe they'll have a blog post eventually, or maybe we should try to get them to write about their experiences after they've been running it for a while.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. If the mining pool is paying out in anything sooner than, I guess, those 100 blocks, then essentially Brains is like fronting that money to the miner by giving them money that isn't quite yet available to them from the Coinbase. That's an interesting point. I'm wondering, yeah, maybe we'll reach out to Brains and see how that's going. It'd be interesting maybe even to have a write-up on Optech if there's something there to talk about for other pools who plan to do something similar. Last piece of software this month, Ledger Bitcoin App 2.2.0 being released. And the headline feature here is Miniscript support for Taproot. I don't really have anything further to drill in on that, Merch.
Yeah, I think it's just cool to see that that went pretty quick. I think Miniscript Taproot support was only merged, late last year, 3 months or so? And I've heard from multiple hardware wallets already that they already support it. So I think all of the, almost all, Frost isn't there yet, but a lot of the things people have been waiting for in Taproot are starting to settle in place. And I mean, it's been active for 2.5 years, so it's high time, but we're starting to see some apps and services roll out their Taproot-based things, but we'll see a lot more of that in the next year now that libraries and services and hardware wallets offer the support for it.
And it doesn't hurt that our friend Salvatore, I think, is heading up this effort and probably nudging that along quickly. I'm not sure of the inner workings there, but obviously he's a big Bitcoiner and big into the tech, so I wouldn't be surprised if he helped nudge that along at Ledger. Next section, releases and release candidates. We have two. First one, Bitcoin Core 26.1, release candidate number 2. A second release candidate for this maintenance release. We've covered the first release candidate a couple of different times. Merch, you mentioned to me offline that there wasn't really anything super notable that changed here in the second release candidate.
Yeah, I think just the block mutation fix, the check whether a block was mutated, got some fixes and was backported to the 26 branch. So, yeah, as we mentioned in the last 2 weeks, this is a maintenance release. This is for people that want to continue to run the 26 branch for the time being, but want to have the bug fixes. So, yeah, if you're looking to stay on that branch, please consider testing. And if you switch to a new version, roll it out first on some nodes, not all.
Bitcoin Core 27.0, release candidate 1. We talked about this release a bit last week, so refer back to podcast 293 for a brief overview. I think we will probably go into more depth potentially with the release of the testing guide, which I actually saw this morning, is up on the repository as of a handful of hours ago. I didn't get a chance to look at the testing guide, but Merch, perhaps we should dive deeper maybe next week, potentially with the testing guide author as a guest.
That sounds great.
Awesome. Notable code and documentation changes. If you have a question for Merch or I, or I see both Sebastian and Russell are still on as well. If you have a question for any of us, now's the time to formulate that and request speaker access or comment on the tweet thread so we can get to that. Bitcoin Core 27.375, which adds support for Unix domain socket communication when Bitcoin Core is communicating with a local Tor proxy. So Unix domain sockets are a faster and potentially more secure way for exchanging data between processes that are executing on the same machine. The faster and more secure is in contrast to using something like TCP/IP, which is currently used. And those TCP/IP sockets currently that are being used as a way to communicate between processes over network, but they have additional overhead. So if you're communicating on the same machine, there could be advantages to using these Unix domain sockets. This PR only uses these faster Unix sockets for local Tor communication as a first use case, but there's plans for future work to roll out Unix sockets more broadly, specifically using Unix sockets for ZMQ, I2P, maybe on Windows where that's possible, and also some places in the GUI as well. Anything to add there, Merch? Okay, thumbs up.
I know nothing about this.
Now you do. Next PR, Bitcoin Core 27.114, allows for whitelisting of manual connections. Whitelist is a startup option for Bitcoin Core that adds permission to the peer connecting from a certain provided IP address. Bitcoin Core previously allowed whitelisting of inbound peers. And when we say whitelisting, this is not some binary whitelist where it's just yes or no, but there are actually several permissions that you can flag as part of the whitelisting. A couple examples, one might be this no ban flag, which means that you won't ban the peer for misbehavior. Another example flag for permission would be the relay permission, which will actually relay and accept transactions from a peer even if you're running in blocks only mode. And there's a handful of other different permissions as well that you can flag using this whitelisting feature. This PR that we're covering this week adds a new field in the whitelist option to specify permission of outbound peers. So my understanding is that after this PR, the whitelist declarations where you outline those flags will have an in or out specifier at the start of the field to designate if the permissions apply to an inbound or outbound connections. Merch?
I think I understand the addition here with this PR a little different. So previously, the whitelist basically only applied to inbound peers. So when another node made a connection to you, you could give it some form of special access. And it would never apply to outbound peers, as in peers that you had tried the connection to create the connection to. So what this allows you is to also give special access to peers that you created the action, the connection to. And so from what I understood, that is the major contribution here, is that you can specify a special access for outbound peers. And I think, for example, where that would be relevant is if you have two nodes that you want to have a privileged connection between, one of them has to initiate. So if the whitelisting properties only happen in one direction, one of them would not get it every time you make the connection, and now it would be bidirectional.
There's a few different interesting resources around this PR that we just discussed. One is there's a BitShala Bitcoin Core PR Review Club, which is separate from the PR Review Club that we normally cover, that does cover this PR 27114. So check that out for some details there. And there's a related PR on the other Bitcoin Core.reviews, the traditional Bitcoin Core PR Review Club that we talk about, for related PR, which is 26441. So if you're interested in this topic, check those out for a little bit more information. Next PR this week, Bitcoin Core 29306, adding sibling eviction for transactions descended from an unconfirmed V3 parent. Merch, I'm punting to you on this one. What's going on here?
Okay, so y'all have probably heard of V3 transactions, or as they have been recently referred to, truck transaction, that is TRUC for topologically restricted until confirmation. So we're thinking here about a set of maximum of two transactions with a cluster limited set of transactions to a cluster of two. There can only be a parent and at most one child. And if there's a child, the child is restricted to 1,000 V bytes. And it can only have that single parent. What that does is it reduces the capacity to do a lot of pinning. And it is, for example, intended to be used with smart contracts where pinning can be a problem, and you want to restrict how much overpayment the other party can incur on you by attaching a big transaction. So when you have a transaction that has multiple outputs and it can only have a single child, you sort of get into the issue where you could have multiple child transactions that don't directly conflict because they don't spend the same output. So in a confirmed situation, both of these transactions could coexist at the same time. But in the restrictions of the track transactions, only one of them is permitted in the mempool at the same time. So far, we have never allowed a transaction that exceeds the descendant limit unless for the CPFP carve-out. And we would just drop them on the floor. This is over the descendant limit, and we don't accept it, and try again later, basically. So in this case, though, with the very limited topology in which the transactions can appear already, we have a few special cases. One is the track transactions always have to be replaceable. So they signal RBF replaceability regardless just by their version. Second, since there's only ever a single child, whether or not you spend the same input, you know exactly which child you might be conflicting with. In a regular transaction situation where you might have up to 25 descendants, it would be a non-trivial question which output you might replace with a new transaction if you were to accept a sibling instead. But with track transactions, since there's only ever a single child, it is obvious that these two children are competing. And then we do what would be the incentive compatible thing to do. We pick the one that pays more fees or pays a, that is more attractive to miners to include in a block. We keep that one instead of just the first one we've seen. So basically, if we had seen them in the opposite order, right now we would also keep the sibling that is evicting the original child. But we apply all the same RBF rules, so you still have to pay more fee rate, you still have to pay a higher total fee. But now you don't have to pay exactly the same input, you just have to pay another output of the same V3 transaction parent. Yeah, so that's basically the idea, and staring at that for quite a bit, even though there is not a direct conflict here, it seems to make sense and it is incentive compatible. So it makes the mempool better for the miners. So yeah, that's basically a sibling eviction.
Merch, we have a question that is tying together a couple of things that we've talked about in this newsletter, and I'm hoping you can help clarify. The question is from Hero Gamer asking, he's linking to the sibling eviction for V3 transactions delving Bitcoin post, which I think is what you sort of just covered, and asking, this idea unlocks the ability to cancel Bitcoin transaction, question mark. So I think it's maybe confusing the sibling eviction with the RBF cancel transaction that we were talking about earlier. Maybe Merch, you can help clarify that this idea of canceling a transaction with RBF, which I think would indicate how it's not related to sibling eviction, unless this is a new way to cancel a transaction that Hero Gamer is talking about.
No, absolutely. So if you're if the other party that is also getting paid by the parent V3 transaction uses the child transaction as a means to perform a payment, then absolutely the counterparty that is using sibling eviction to supplant the original child with its own child is basically canceling the payment of the original child. But I mean, in the context of where V3 is intended to be used, that would basically be uncommon, I would say. Usually your intent is here to, for example, bump a commitment transaction to get it confirmed in order to, for example, unilaterally close a Lightning channel or other smart contracts, coin joins, whatever. And here I think the main intent of the child transaction usually would be to reprioritize the parent and get it confirmed, especially in the context of, for example, either minimum fee rate or zero fee rate commitment transactions. So making a payment with the transaction that bumps the commitment would be unusual, I say. But in that sense, yes, you could basically cancel a payment that another party has performed.
Thanks for clarifying that, Merch. Hero Gamer, I hope that answers your question. XPR, LND 8310, which adds support for the ability to have sensitive configuration options, specifically the RPC user login and the RPC password options, to be pulled from the operating system's environment variables. which better protects those potential secrets compared to those values just sitting in a plain text configuration file. So previously, LND forced users to have the username and password secrets in clear text in that configuration file. And now that can be pulled from the environmental variables for the operating system. And we note in the write-up also a use case for this is being able to have the LND configuration file be version controlled without storing the actual username and password in that version controlled configuration file. And this is something, Merch, that I understand that Bitcoin Core already does similarly support such configuration. Is that right?
Honestly, I don't know.
Me neither. I read it somewhere. Rust Bitcoin 2458 adds support for signing Taproot in PSBT to Rust Bitcoin. And I thought it was interesting that this pull request actually came from a downstream user of the Rust Bitcoin library, a developer from the Keystone Wallet team. And so the Keystone Wallet team created an issue on the GitHub for Taproot support in PSBT. But not only that, but they also then, I think it was about a week later, opened this PR, which was very much welcomed by the Rust Bitcoin devs. One of the devs noting, quote, "This is awesome. Thanks a million for working on this. And also, it has been sorely needed for a long time and no one has gotten around to it. Really appreciate your efforts." So you'd love to see, in this case, I believe, a commercial user of open source actually committing some code to the repository that they use for features that they want. So that's nice to see. So I wanted to highlight that. Merch, any comments on this Rust Bitcoin PR? Well, thank you to our special guests, Russell, AJ, and Sebastian. And thanks always to my co-host, Merch. That was a great newsletter, great recap, and we'll see you next week.
See you next week.